local time, Iraqi troops crossed the eastern border of Kuwait.
Iraq has moved into Kuwait with more than 100,000
troops. President Saddam Hussein commands over a million combat-tested troops, thousands of tanks.
On August the 2nd, 1990, Saddam Hussein's forces crossed the border into Kuwait, triggering the largest international crisis since the collapse of the Soviet Union. A coalition force led by the United States is assembled, and then launches a massive air assault against Iraq before finally starting the largest ground offensive ever since World War II in the name of liberating Kuwait. On February the 28th, 1991, having fulfilled its mission, the international coalition abruptly stops the war against Iraq. The last Iraqi troops are evicted from Kuwait or taken prisoners. Victory is total. However, a decade after it was imposed to force Saddam out of Kuwait, the embargo over Iraq is still in place.
That assault had absolutely nothing to do with freedom and democracy.
You had to keep the image of the good guys.
So the press was kept out.
It is Hitler and Iraq fell in it.
The U.S. wanted that war.
The mosquitoes and flies put up a bigger fight than they did.
A large portion of Saddam's army never came into Kuwait.
They did not see tank tracks in the sand in the desert.
There was no war. Iraq was defenseless.
This is genocide, period.
Very naive that somehow sanctions would lead to the removal of Saddam Hussein.
The embargo strengthened the regime of Saddam Hussein.
The CIA actually supported Saddam Hussein and his Ba'ath Party.
Perhaps they have other secret intentions which I am not aware of.
If in fact the government lied, does that surprise anyone?
To understand why this embargo still stands and why the Gulf War happened in the first place, it is necessary to look at the history of Western involvement in the Middle East. In the 1920s, European and American oil companies discover and begin to exploit the first oil fields in the Middle East. The potential of these fields would become particularly critical to oil-poor Western Europe. The profit margins are huge, while the cut to local regimes is minimal, and the price of oil at the well is almost the same as mineral water. World War II changes this equation. Despite their victory over Nazi Germany, both France and England are gravely debilitated and begin losing their grip over their former colonies. In the Middle East, new leaders come to power, removing monarchies no longer protected by the former colonial forces and swept away by popular revolutions. However, the British and French role in the Middle East is now being taken over by the big winner of the war, the United States of America. Despite its own oil resources, the US comes to realize the strategic importance of the Middle East oil. To contain the Soviet Union, to rebuild Western Europe, and to confirm the American industrial boom. But Washington hopes to maintain the inexpensive Middle East oil bonanza of before World War II. The new Middle East regimes think otherwise, and when they seek to retake control of their own national wealth, it strikes a chord of panic in Washington, London and Paris. It is war against Egypt when Nasser seizes the Suez Canal. In Iran, Mossadegh nationalizes oil fields and kicks the British oil companies out. He is subsequently ousted by a CIA-orchestrated coup that puts the Shah back in command. In Iraq, as General Abdel Karim Qassem takes over and nationalizes the oil fields, the West cries, communism.
Ahmed al-Bayati, Iraqi opposition delegate in London.
Saddam came to power in 1968.
This coup came as a result of an oil deal between Iraq and French company IRAB. This contract upset the West in general and the Americans in particular, so they encouraged a coup in Iraq at that time.
The United States has had sort of a love-hate relationship with Saddam Hussein, which is not something that a lot of people in this country are aware of.
International arms trade analyst Bill Hartung.
But going back to the late 50s and early 60s, when the CIA actually supported Saddam Hussein and his Ba'ath Party in the coup that brought him to power.
Former Iraqi oil minister Fidel Chalabi.
The vice prime minister, Ba'ath, called As-Sadi, said in a book which he published in Beirut that we, the Ba'athists, came to power in an American train. He said that.
Despite his already well-known ruthlessness, Saddam Hussein remained the good guy of the West until 1972. This year, the OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, agrees to raise the price of the barrel from $3 to $22. Iraq follows suit and nationalizes its oil fields. Saddam is then deemed unreliable by Washington, and as a result, branded a terrorist leader. The U.S. then shifts all of its support to its long-standing ally in the region, the Shah of Iran.
Ramsey Clark.
For 25 years, from 1953, the Shah of Iran was the U.S. surrogate in the Persian Gulf and Middle East region. The U.S. sold him about $22 billion in arms from 1972 to 1976. The Shah was our man.
The hope of control by the West of the Middle East fades in 1979 when the Shah is overthrown by anti-Western fundamentalist leader Ayatollah Khomeini. By then, Saddam Hussein becomes again a viable card in Washington's hand. He becomes the actual president of Iraq after 11 years of being its vice president, and then perpetrates a sweeping purge of his opponents and attacks Iran without provocation or apparent reason.
Bill Hartung.
The Stockholm Peace Research Institute has found that 52 different countries supplied weapons to Iran or Iraq, and 29 countries supplied both sides. So the very same countries that were saying how horrible the war was were using that war to stimulate their arms industries, to test some of their new weapons designs.
David Welch, U.S. Department of State.
We did have some very limited engagement with the government of Iraq, actually a lot less so than other governments. And both protagonists were under arms embargoes during that period, arms embargoes that the United States, for its part, did not violate.
Bill Hartung.
The United States was perhaps the most hypocritical of the countries that supplied arms for the war, because its public position was, we're not going to arm Iran, we're not going to arm Iraq, when quietly, secretly, they were actually arming both sides of the conflict.
Saddam Hussein's ambition, however, is to develop Iraq's own non-conventional mass destruction weapons. An inquiry conducted by the U.S. Congress in 1992 reveals the American contribution to this effort is quite significant as well, and fully monitored by the CIA and the U.S. State Department, whose reports as early as the late 70s have been detailing the extent of Iraq's mass destruction weapon programs and its repetitive use of chemical weapons against Iranian troops and Kurdish opponents.
David Welch, U.S. Department of State.
In 1988, we had no idea that Saddam Hussein would be using chemical weapons on his own people. If we had known all this in advance, we would have made our policy quite a bit different in 1988, I'm sure.
Voices start being heard within the U.S. government asking about the wisdom of giving Iraq huge credits intended for purchasing U.S. agricultural goods, but used instead to buy helicopters, armored trucks, unreasonable amounts of pesticides, germs, and advanced arms-making technologies. The U.S. State Department and the White House under Presidents Reagan and then Bush systematically quell all the inquiry attempts from Congress and the Treasury Department. From massive arms purchases to the development of costly military research programs, Saddam Hussein has ruined formerly rich Iraq.